This podcast is presented by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at www.uctv.tv. Enjoy the presentation.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and thank you for attending our annual DeWitt-Higgs Memorial Lecture. I'm Steve Adler, Provost of Earl Warren College, Professor in the Department of Theater and Dance, and also Director of the Law and Society Program here at UCSD, and it's our great pleasure to welcome you. On behalf of our Chancellor, Dr. Marianne Fox, the Dean of Arts and Humanities, Michael Bernstein, Dean of Social Sciences, Paul Drake, and the Dean of the California Western School of Law, Stephen Smith, I welcome you to UCSD and to the Higgs Lecture. The lecture is designed to present the UCSD and San Diego communities with an evening of stimulating discourse on a legal topic of contemporary importance. I fervently believe that tonight's lecture by the Right Honorable Jeff Hoon, the United Kingdom Minister for Europe, will accomplish the goals of the Higgs Lecture in exemplary fashion. I would like to also point out that we have a Union Jack on stage with us as a welcoming note. It is now my great pleasure to introduce you to a distinguished scientist, distinguished scholar, and a nationally recognized leader in higher education, the Chancellor of the University of California, San Diego, Dr. Marianne Fox.
Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you so much for coming to this very important event in the life of the university. The Higgs Lecture, of course, is an annual endowed lecture that focuses on a legal topic and its impact on society, highlighting the effect of law and legislation on individual and national rights. It's very important that education has a similar effect in the way we conduct our own lives, and here at UCSD, our scholarship and research are interdisciplinary, innovative, and international. It's quite fitting under those circumstances for our faculty, staff, and students to come together to benefit from the kind of engagement which will result from the lecture today. Our first goal is to promote student awareness of the effect of the law and legislation on individuals. Second is to encourage all of us in society to think critically and to engage ourselves much more fully as productive members of our own society. And finally, to strengthen the connection between UCSD and the Cal Western School of Law through this common global community which is evolving. So it is with great pleasure that you've joined us tonight. We're delighted that you've been able to do so for tonight's lecture entitled Civil Liberties and the War on Terrorism. I hope you'll all enjoy the presentation. Thank you very much for coming.
This is a special time in history. Indeed, there are times in history where change is so significant that they are fairly called turning points, and the last decade appears to be just such a time. Our Higgs lecture tonight has been in the middle of making the decisions that have addressed these changes, and if the title were not already taken, I would suggest the title of this presentation be Present at the Creation. Consider the three of the developments that are defining the beginning of this century and which Mr. Hoon has faced: terrorism, new forms of warfare that are emerging, and the development of Europe as a unified economic and even political force. Jeff Hoon was born in Derby and received a Bachelor of Arts and Master's degree from Cambridge. He was called to the bar at Gray's Inn. He taught at law at the University of Leeds and the University of Louisville before entering political life. He is married to Elaine, and it is my joy to introduce Elaine, who has joined Jeff. Thank you very much, Elaine, for being with us. They have three wonderful children who may also learn to serve. In 1984, Jeff Hoon was elected as a member of the European Parliament, where he served with distinction for 10 years. In 1992, he was elected as a member of the British House of Commons. And in 1998, he became Minister of State in the Lord Chancellor's Department and served in other leadership positions before, in 1999, becoming the UK Secretary of Defense. He served from 1999 to 2005 in that position, and think about the change and the extraordinary events between 1999 and 2005. Among the questions of war, defense, and peace that he presided over during that time, he also presided over a topic that has been the subject of two previous Higgs lecture in part, which was the elimination of the discrimination based on sexual orientation in the military in the United Kingdom. In 2005, he served as leader of the House of Commons and more recently has been the Minister of State for Europe. As a dedicated public servant with great experience as a lawyer, parliamentarian, and defense minister, Jeff Hoon is especially well-placed to consider the great challenges presented by the war on terrorism and the conflict of that war on terrorism with our dedication to human rights and human values. So to discuss that conflict of values, it is a pleasure to present the Right Honorable Minister, Jeffrey William Hoon.
Ladies and gentlemen, could I say how delighted I am, first of all, to be here in San Diego. I'm extremely grateful for this opportunity to visit with you and to speak to you. And I'm particularly pleased to have the privilege of giving the DeWitt Higgs Memorial Lecture. I know that DeWitt Higgs was a real pillar of the San Diego legal community and a founding member of the firm Higgs, Fletcher & Mack. I know as well that he put back a great deal into this community by, amongst other contributions, serving as a regent for 16 years and as a trustee of the California Western School of Law. I hope that in my remarks this evening that I can reflect some of that combined commitment to law and society that I know that he demonstrated throughout his life. And if the UCSD will forgive me, I would also like to thank in particular my former very good friend Steve Smith for this opportunity. We were friends for many years, working together in the law school at the University of Louisville in Kentucky. Indeed, some British journalists, as you heard, got wind of our friendship several years ago when they were, as they did quite a lot, predicting my political demise. Given my background as a constitutional lawyer and one who had previously lectured in the United States, they suggested perhaps that I might be coming to work here. I have to say that the people who were most disappointed when they discovered that this story was not true were my children. Their bags were already packed, ready to go, and they have only recently forgiven me. San Diego is, of course, famous for very many things. Its zoo, the Hotel del Coronado, probably the best climate in the United States, certainly better than the United Kingdom's. But most of all, of course, for your support for the armed forces, and particularly for the United States Navy. This is something I was very much aware of during my period as the United Kingdom Defence Secretary, as you've heard, from 1999 until 2005. To say the least, that was an eventful time in the history of our armed forces, the history of our two countries, and indeed, for that matter, the rest of the world. During that period, British forces took action to prevent ethnic cleansing of the Muslim population of Kosovo. They intervened to defeat the rebels and restore democracy in Sierra Leone. They assisted in toppling the brutal Taliban regime in Afghanistan, and they helped secure the first democratic elections in Iraq for very many years. There are some common threads running through all of those interventions. They were all controversial, and they all relied on our close friends in the United States. This is something I like to think that I appreciate more than most people. Having mentioned my children, I hope that you will excuse me for giving a very personal explanation of why I'm here in the United States. And indeed, from that personal perspective, why our two countries are so close. My father's much older brother fought in the First World War. And like millions of others on his return home, he decided to look for a new life for his then young wife and family. So they left for the United States in the early 1920s, and as a result, I have more family members in the United States than in the United Kingdom. The American Hoons are obviously more prolific than their British counterparts. One of their children served in the United States Air Force during the Second World War and was stationed in the United Kingdom. Unfortunately, at that time, he did not actually meet my father, his uncle, who was coincidentally serving in the Royal Air Force in the Far East. Two closely related young men serving their countries a long way from home, fighting on the same side against violent and oppressive totalitarian regimes. Fortunately, they both returned home safely and in turn produced another generation of Hoons on both sides of the Atlantic. And thanks to cheap travel, my generation was able to meet far more often than our predecessors had done. But even then, we did not have the immediacy of contact available to our own children, who use the internet today to discuss rather more immediate events, such as perhaps what happened in school or their favourite professor or otherwise. That is why, whenever I can, I've had the opportunity to visit this remarkable and dynamic country. As you've heard, I lectured in Kentucky in my 20s. I've had the opportunity to travel widely around the states of this wonderful country. Indeed, so far, I've been to 46. So in my case, the United States and the United Kingdom share a very personal connection. It's a truism to say that the United Kingdom and the United States share far more when we examine our legal and political heritage. We share the same values, a belief in democracy, in freedom, in the rule of law. Our countries have stood together in the face of common threats: fascism in the 1940s, communism throughout the Cold War. Now we stand together as partners in a global effort to counter the threat of international terrorism. In each case, by standing together, we have upheld the values we share in common. On the 9th of November 1989, I visited Berlin, then as a member of the European Parliament, to attend what was apparently going to be a routine meeting of the European Parliament's Legal Affairs Committee. A few weeks earlier, on a brief visit to East Berlin, I had witnessed the demonstrations that were then becoming almost a daily part of life in that part of the city. So in November, I wanted to see what had happened in the meantime. And I walked from the Reichstag along the wall to Checkpoint Charlie. Unfortunately, the East German border guards would not accept my European Parliament travel documents. Incredible to think that at that stage, East Germany, now part of the European Union, did not recognise the existence of either the European Parliament or, for that matter, the European Union. This was at about 8:30 that evening. That night, the wall came down and thousands of young East Germans flooded into the West. I may well have been, therefore, the very last person in history to be refused entry to East Berlin. Those momentous events led, of course, to far-reaching changes in Central and Eastern Europe. Former members of the Warsaw Pact became part of the NATO alliance, and former Soviet states became part of the European Union. That led to fundamental changes in defence policy. And during my time as Defence Secretary, most of the policy initiatives that I was responsible for were taken up with restructuring our armed forces to tackle the challenges of that post-Cold War global environment. Forces were moved from fixed bases in Germany and other Cold War outposts to more flexible positions. Investment was shifted from heavy artillery to lightweight, high-tech weaponry. There was an emphasis on rapid deployment and quick reaction. Military cooperation began with countries that were once our enemies in the Warsaw Pact. They, of course, have also had to restructure their armed forces. Ironically, forces that were organised to fight each other in a conventional war on the West German plain are now both going through the same painful process of change and reconstruction to be able to fight alongside each other in the great challenges of the 21st century. Above all else, the threat of global terrorism. It might come as a surprise to some people in this room, but many in my country and right across Europe do not fully appreciate or understand the profound impact here in the United States of those appalling attacks in New York on September the 11th, 2001. The extent of the reaction here was brought home to me by an old friend from Louisville in Kentucky, not somewhere that perhaps would be considered as an obvious target for terrorists. I spoke to him a year after the attacks, and he told me that he and his wife were only then feeling that it was safe to go out to restaurants for dinner. I repeated that story at home, and I think it shocked many of my friends and counterparts. But my sense is that it was not at the time a particularly unusual response. But as we all know in this room, terrorists have not just killed innocent civilians in the United States. Since 2002, there have been terrorist atrocities in countries as diverse as Indonesia, Turkey, Spain, Egypt, and of course the United Kingdom. And the terrorist threat did not begin in 2001. There were many earlier attacks and failed plots on the road to 9/11, including the horrific attacks on US embassies in East Africa in 1998 and on US forces in Saudi Arabia in 1996. These attacks have opened the eyes of all of our people to the threats we face, but different countries have responded in different ways. After the 7/7 attacks in London, when over 50 people were murdered on the London Underground by British-born suicide bombers, the city was in a state of shock. But what was perhaps remarkable was how quickly the city got back to normal. Following day, people continued to use the Underground in significant numbers, carrying on their daily lives, not letting the terrorists win. In so many ways, this British characteristic is admirable. It showed itself during the Blitz, when our courage confounded Nazi efforts to intimidate the United Kingdom by indiscriminate bombing. And it defeated the IRA terrorist campaign on the streets of London. But at the same time, the other side of this great British trait is scepticism. Scepticism about the motives of government in tackling the challenges our country faces. This scepticism is a healthy and necessary ingredient of a mature democratic society, and a helpful and necessary constraint on overeager politicians who might be tempted to cast away our hard-won civil liberties without an appropriate justification. But I suspect it might surprise many in an American audience just how politically difficult it has been for us to introduce measures requested by our security services to assist in their work in tackling terrorism. We in the government judged that these changes, including extending the length of time the terrorist suspects could be held for questioning before being charged, were necessary because the threat which we face today is on a different scale from anything we have faced before. The perpetrators of today's threats belong to brutal global networks intent on indiscriminate killing. Al-Qaeda's so-called representatives have announced repeatedly and unashamedly that you will love life, but we love death. Osama bin Laden and his lieutenants are willing to train young people to give up their lives as human suicide bombs to kill as many innocent people as possible. It cannot even be said that religion is their motive, because I would assess that many more Muslims have been killed by suicide bombers in recent years than the number of believers from all other faiths combined. This threat is nothing like nothing that we have seen before, a murderous mindset with political demands that are completely unacceptable in a modern and civilised world, and involving a different magnitude, aiming for mass casualties in so-called spectacular attacks. I would never downplay the bloodthirstiness of terrorists in the past on both sides during our troubles in Northern Ireland. But Al-Qaeda's complete contempt for the value of human life, both Muslim and non-Muslim, is on a completely different scale. And let us not be under any illusion about Al-Qaeda's targeting. Look at their bombing of a wedding party in a hotel in Jordan, a strike at the heart of multicultural London, or their merciless attacks on ordinary Iraqis. They kill men, women and children without compunction. Yet, as I've already indicated, it has sometimes proved difficult to get support in the House of Commons, particularly amongst opposition parties, for new measures to strengthen our terrorist legislation. All European countries are grappling with the same questions as we seek to defend our people and protect our liberties that we hold dear. What extra support do our security services need? Does this require new legislation? How can we legislate without damaging our civil liberties? Do we need to protect these liberties with further legal guarantees? These questions go to the very heart of the current legal and political debate. How do we balance an individual's liberties with a state's responsibility, overriding responsibility, to protect them from terrorism? This new age of global terrorism that recognises neither national nor legal boundaries, states must act together to protect civilised society from the risk of attacks. These actions will inevitably, in turn, have the effect of, to some extent, limiting individual liberty. The key questions are how far and whether this is a price worth paying. Or are we all, as some of our critics would suggest, simply doing the work of the terrorists for them? This debate has recent historical roots, actually in the Cold War. One of Britain's greatest political philosophers, Isaiah Berlin, warned against the dangers of state intervention restricting the liberty of the individual. His critique was then directed at the authoritarian state of the Soviet Union, which used a contorted version of the concept of liberty to justify its otherwise unjustifiable actions. It was during the Cold War and its subsequent thaw, the emphasis in the West was on how an individual's action should not be overly restricted by the action of the state or by the intervention of the state. That difference helped us to define the free countries of the West against the oppressive state power of the Soviet bloc. But the threat that causes restraint today no longer comes from a state. The global terrorist threat that we face today is unpredictable and indiscriminate. Given the extremes to which terrorists are willing to go, we may need to reconsider our approach to dealing with those who pose a real risk to the very fabric of our societies. We have to make and we have to win the arguments for this state intervention. There is an obvious and indeed understandable reluctance from many liberal-minded commentators from across the political divide to accept these arguments. But we need to show that our cherished modern concept of liberty will not work if we cannot guarantee the basic freedom of security. Winning these arguments in our countries and indeed across the world is our common challenge. The battle against terrorism is a truly global effort, marked more clearly than ever before by the fact of global interdependence. And terrorists use those freedoms to exploit this. Travelling from country to country, using electronic financial networks to channel their funds, the internet to spread their message, the latest technologies to communicate with each other. This is highlighted more than ever during the September 11 attacks. Training and planning in the Far East, bases in Europe for preparing the attacks, constant travelling to perfect the arrangements. It follows that we can only defeat this threat by working and cooperating together, still more effectively than we did in the past, against the more conventional threats to our freedoms. I've set out the similarities between our two countries in terms of values, but of course when it comes to tackling these challenges, we have rather different constitutional arrangements. You have a written constitution, we do not. You have a presidential system with many checks and balances, a strong Congress and powerful states. We have a doctrine of parliamentary sovereignty, with individual members of parliament elected from constituencies around the country. Your most senior judges sit in a Supreme Court. Ours are, for the moment at any rate, in the House of Lords, at least before we create our own Supreme Court. You have a Bill of Rights. We have the European Convention on Human Rights. And the European dimension is of particular relevance for me, because, as you know, I am currently the Minister for Europe in the British government. For the United Kingdom, the way we tackle this threat must be seen in a European context. Indeed, against the backdrop of the rights guaranteed under the European Convention, we have brought in our own domestic legislation. Now, the Prevention of Terrorism Act 2005 brought about a new system of control orders for terrorist suspects, and the Terrorism Acts of 2000 and 2006 contain a number of measures to provide our enforcement agencies with the tools that they need to tackle terrorism. Much of my time as Minister for Europe is spent working with counterparts in other European countries. In response to the escalation of terrorist attacks in recent years, we have intensified cooperation with European partners to fight cross-border crime and terrorism. During the United Kingdom's six-month presidency of the European Union in 2005, we exported our four-pronged counter-terrorism strategy, the four P's of prevent, pursue, protect and prepare. One key success is the European arrest warrant, which has greatly facilitated the extradition of suspected terrorists from one member state to another. In cooperation with our European partners, we're currently refining a complementary measure, the European evidence warrant, that will streamline the process of exchanging evidence for criminal proceedings. This will prevent criminals escaping charges as a result of evidence gathered in one country not being automatically admissible in the legal system of another European state. Terrorists use global networks. Their level of sophistication often allows them to travel across borders undetected. To combat this, the European Union has put in place Europe-wide legislation to crack down on money laundering and to enable the freezing of the assets of suspected criminal networks. There is also, rightly, an emphasis on prevention. We need to understand the origins and motivations of those new threats, not least in the United Kingdom, when our own citizens are involved. What ultimately motivates the men and women who are the frontline criminal elements of these global terrorist networks? The European Union is therefore carrying out detailed work into how to best pursue counter-radicalisation. But we cannot just operate within the borders of the European Union and hope for the best. Terrorist networks, as I keep saying, are global. The European Union is therefore actively involved in building technical capacity in third countries where the threat is highest and there is a lack of government infrastructure to respond to it. These European initiatives need to be replicated on a global scale. The United Kingdom has strong bilateral links with the United States on these issues, as well as participating in European Union-United States cooperation. However, we could and should do more together. The stereotypical distinction between the United States and the European Union in this field is that the US is more interested in pursuing terrorists and the EU more focused on preventing terrorism. However, we should not allow those stereotypes to distort our view of reality. Both of these P's, pursue and prevent, are necessary and complementary. We can learn from each other in both of these areas, as well as cooperate together more closely and more effectively. The extent to which the state should intervene to both prevent terrorism and pursue terrorists depends on the necessary balance between individual civil liberties and the right to security. The legal parameters of this debate deserve further consideration. Just as you have the US Bill of Rights, we have the European Convention on Human Rights. Our common law in the United Kingdom is now underpinned by the European Convention, which are designed to further protect human rights and fundamental freedoms. If I may describe it in this way, the classical civil and political rights, the right to life, to liberty and security, to a fair trial, to freedom of expression. And it's worth for a moment considering the historical context of the European Convention on Human Rights. It was drafted in the post-war period of the late 1940s and early 1950s, in direct reaction to the abuse of state power by the Nazis, but with the oppressive state communism of the Soviet Union clearly in mind. There is no question that it remains a vital protection of our fundamental freedoms. But like all such documents, it needs to evolve and develop in the light of changes in the wider world. The question we now face is whether this document remains entirely adequate to deal with non-state global terrorist organisations. And two articles of the Convention are particularly relevant to this question. Article 17 provides that no one may use the rights guaranteed by the Convention to seek the abolition or limitation of the rights guaranteed by the Convention itself. Shouting down someone exercising a right to free speech will not be protected. But it raises much more difficult questions about, for example, the limit of religious freedom. Does it include preaching the virtues of a holy war against the Western infidel in the mosques of our own towns and cities? Article 15 does provide a derogation from the rights guaranteed by the Convention in time of war or other public emergency threatening the life of the nation. Now, those that drafted this provision had two world wars in mind, vast conflicts that, in the case of the Second World War, was fought out in almost every corner of the globe by state actors. In the 21st century, faced with the scale of the terror threats that I've outlined, there must be a question about the extent to which these articles are sufficient today to deal with the problems posed by non-state actors like Al-Qaeda. Inevitably and rightly, clauses allowing derogations from the basic principles are tightly drawn and tightly interpreted. I would not argue with such an approach for one moment, but it is worth noting that they were written long before the idea of international terrorist organisations with such massive destructive force were even thought of. This new global threat may well, therefore, require a new legal approach, one that recognises that threats to our way of life may not only come from state actors in time of war, but from less structured, less organised organisations with a global reach. It could be the only way in which we can confidently guarantee the security of our citizens and the rights that they enjoy. Like the United States, we will face many similar challenges. I do not want to leave anyone in this room in any doubt. There will be more difficult times ahead for the United States, for the European Union, and indeed for the whole of the civilised democratic world. I recognise today that I have not set out all of the possible solutions, but I believe that we are on the right track, defending our values, taking difficult decisions to protect our freedoms, but most importantly, standing and working together. No country can win this battle on its own. The close, personal friendship between the United States and the United Kingdom will go on making a real difference and a real contribution. I'm most grateful for your kindness and indeed for your attention. Thank you very much.
My name is Gershon Shafir, and I'm the director of the Institute for International Comparative and Area Studies here at UCSD. I also teach a course on international terrorism, which every year I have to cap at 150. But I believe I've been asked to be the moderator because I'm the only one here who doesn't have a law degree and will not make any procedural objections. I would like to thank the Honorable Jeff Hoon on a sweeping vista and a thoughtful but passionately felt a speech. I also would like to introduce the two members of this panel, one of them from UCSD, the other one from the California Western School of Law, and I would like to start with William Acevis, who sits at the end of the stable. He's a professor of law and also the director of the International Legal Studies Program at the California Western School of Law. And he has been involved in several ways in the addressing issues that have been raised here today. For example, to the Center for Constitutional Rights. He also has been the principal author of the 2002 Amnesty International USA report on torture. The second panelist is our own Patrick Patterson, who is an assistant professor in the Department of History here, but has an interesting history with a BA degree in religion, a JD from the University of Virginia School of Law, and subsequently a PhD in history. His area of expertise is Eastern Europe, in particular the Balkans, which I believe has led him to focus on areas, topics such as war crimes, genocide, but also on freedom of expression. The remaining of this evening is going to be divided in two parts. First, I'm going to ask the two panelists to offer some comments in response to Jeff Hoon's speech. And then we'll open the floor up. There is, I believe, two mics here, and you'll be asked to walk over to them and pose a question. The one thing I would like you to keep in mind is that we only have three speakers, and everybody else can ask questions. So make sure that what you do is you ask a question to last no more than a minute. I would like to ask William and then Patrick to comment.
It is really a pleasure to be here. Good afternoon and good evening. Our speaker referenced the European Court, the European Convention on Human Rights, and it truly is an extraordinary document in terms of providing perhaps one of the most successful mechanisms for the protection of human rights in the world today. And it's interesting to note that as we reflect on this period in history and we reflect on what it will mean for democracy in 10 or 20 years, I think the legacy won't be looking at Guantanamo as a mechanism for promoting democracy. I think rather it's going to be how the law responds to that, how lawyers responded to not only the threats posed by terrorism, but also by the responses of civil society. And I think referencing the European Convention on Human Rights is valuable because the European Convention contains this derogation clause, which in times of national crisis authorized the member states to derogate from its core obligations. And in fact, the United Kingdom sought to derogate from some of those core responsibilities after 9/11. That case went before the British House of Lords. And the House of Lords responded that the derogation was in fact not appropriate, that the United Kingdom was not faced with that type of fundamental threat to its very existence, and that because of that, the United Kingdom should not be allowed to indefinitely detain aliens in the United Kingdom based upon the purported threat of international terrorism. And I think that as we think about the balance between civil liberties and security, I think we should always look first to the law and recognize that the law does have mechanisms in place that can recognize the distinctions between those threats which require some type of a significant response and perhaps even on occasion a curtailment of civil liberties from those situations that do not require that degree of restriction on those civil liberties that we hold dear. Europe. And it's striking to note how not only the British House of Lords, but also the Canadian Supreme Court, and also our own U.S. Supreme Court, on those cases when they've been confronted with this balancing test of civil liberties or national security, in each of the cases that I've seen, those courts have chosen in favor of civil liberties. Whether it was our Supreme Court in the Hamdi case, in Rasool, or in Hamdan from last year, whether it was that the two decisions issued by the British House of Lords, another decision finding that the UK could not use any evidence acquired through torture, or whether it was the decision of the Canadian Supreme Court earlier this year also prohibiting indefinite detention. So I think as we reflect upon this debate, I think it's valuable to recognize the important role that law has to play, and also recognize that I'd like to think so far, for the most part, the Supreme Courts of the United States, Canada, and the United Kingdom have gotten it right so far.
Well, again, thanks to all of you for the opportunity to be here. I'd like to speak historically and comparatively. We're supposed to be very, very brief, and I'll try to do that. I take a somewhat less sanguine view, actually. And while Mr. Hoon's presentation stressed the commonalities in the Anglo and American legal traditions and political traditions, to my mind, I think it's important to recognize that the United States is a substantially more libertarian and individualistic country and legal culture than the UK. And the UK is itself more libertarian and individualistic than Europe. And I am not comforted, really, to see as a let me put the cards on the table. I'm a near absolutist when it comes to civil liberties, and I'm quite comfortable with the American tradition. To see the UK pulled not toward the American model, but toward the European continental model, in which not only things like the derogation clauses, but the general tendency to understand liberties as subject to applicable law. Well, the subject to applicable law tends to, too often to my mind, to swallow up the liberty that's being guaranteed. And so I look at what is happening, or to my mind threatens to happen, in the UK as the result of this this particular part of joining Europe. And mind you, I think that in general the British collaboration with and close cooperation with Europe is a very good thing. But here I think there is actually there's a tendency that might erode what I believe to be a very important part of the Anglo-American legal tradition. I think you're going the wrong way. And I think it's important to note here that history matters. The continent has a different experience from that of the United Kingdom when it comes to civil liberties. The continent has states that are traditionally much stronger. And the peoples and the governments and the legal establishments of the continent are by and large much more comfortable with restricting freedom in the interest of order. And this gives me cause for concern. To call attention to the differences I see, for instance, between the U.S. and UK system, you mentioned this example of the right to preach jihad. And I note that the British government, one of the British government's efforts to combat terrorism, broadly speaking, was to criminalize the, quote, glorification of terrorism. And this is something that in the United States libertarian tradition just simply would not fly. That would be a non-starter here, I believe, at least as a matter of serious legal proposal, serious governmental policy. Doesn't mean to say that a lot of people might not want to be behind it, but the landscape is a different landscape in the United States. So I think it could be interesting to tease out some of the differences between the, as I see it, really three different traditions.
Not for the first time this evening, I'm feeling my age. because as a young university lecturer, one of the very first courses that I taught in an English university was on civil liberties, and I wish that I still had the certainty and the clarity, the absolutism that I had then. And I recognize that the perhaps corrosive effects of office have, to some extent, changed my perspective. And I'm going to do something which I think is fairly brave for a politician. I'm going to talk about Guantanamo. Because the problem that we had, certainly in the United Kingdom, was that three or four people were captured by British forces in northern Afghanistan who had a known terrorist background. They weren't there on vacation. I've been to northern Afghanistan. It's not a place that I would recommend to anyone even today, although it's a great deal better than it was. They had not committed any offence in British law. They'd not committed any offence in US law. But they were bad guys. Let's be clear about it. Now, a government has a choice in that situation. It can say, yes, I remember Mr. Hoon's lectures on civil liberties. They were tremendous. They were very clear. They were absolute. These people should be free. And let's say, for want of a better example, they decide to free them in Mr. Hoon's district, where he rather likes enjoying the confidence of his constituents, who fortunately so far have elected him year in, year out. And they say, hang on a second, why are you letting these bad guys go? Are you really going to take the risk that they are going to commit further terrorist actions, not this time in northern Afghanistan, but in your district? Discuss.
Discuss.
While you're waiting for questions from the audience, bad guys, presumption of innocence.
They haven't committed an offence. I concede that they are innocent of any criminal offence.
And so I have to go back to one of the most core principles of liberal democracy that we trace back in the United States to our English brethren and relatives, which is the presumption of innocence. If they're bad guys, have they done something? Have they conspired? If not, then that is one of the most fundamental principles of liberal democracy. And can't do anything to them until they have.
Well, I can see that this is going to be an interesting evening.
Gershon, can I get in there too? Can I chime in?
Yes.
I believe that to frame it in this way, in your remarks, you said, and the overriding interest in security, national security and public security, to frame it that way is to answer the question ab initio, is to answer it from the beginning. And it just moves us away from fundamental features of liberal democracies, such as the presumption of innocence. With respect to the bad guys point, one of my students, the day or two after the Abu Ghraib scandal became public, one of my students in a little class of about 15 said, "You know, remember, these are bad guys." And essentially, she was not troubled. She was not troubled by the treatment that the photographic evidence seemed to prove had taken place. And what I said to her was, remember, you couldn't do that to these people even if they had been convicted of the crimes. So, and things are happening with respect to the techniques of interrogation and so forth that I believe you can make a pretty strong case that would not be legal, you know, as punishments and are, for that reason, all the more troubling to see them done when you're dealing with somebody who has to be presumed innocent.
How effective has this war on terror been? Thousands and thousands of Middle Eastern people in America were rounded up after September 11th. How many convictions or even indictments did it produce? There's 600 people sitting in Guantanamo for years and years and years, and finally maybe 30 or 35 of them will be charged. The war in Iraq, as terrorist as Saddam Hussein has been, the Iraqis now live under greater terror than they did before. There have been thousands and thousands of potentially illegal wiretaps and spying in America without judicial approval. This is my final question. Okay. How many indictments and bad guys have been uncovered? How has the reputation of Bush and the reputation of Blair, both powerful leaders when they took office, how has it been affected, and how is it likely to be remembered by the effectiveness and intelligence and sanity of their war on terror?
Okay. Another question? Okay. I don't see anybody else.
Well, I guess that was probably directed at me.
All three.
I'll do my best. First of all, I set out very clearly that these events didn't start on 9/11, and they didn't certainly start when coalition forces invaded Iraq. Now, we could have simply looked the other way, and for a period of time, actually, that is what happened. We looked the other way. Al-Qaeda tried to topple the World Trade Center long before it succeeded on 9/11. Now, how do you deal with that? The difference we have here is about the extent to which the law should protect absolutely the rights of individual citizens, albeit ones who I would judge to be heavily engaged in terrorist action, albeit outside the jurisdiction. And the questions that I was posing were questions that, frankly, run through all of the points that you were raising. They're this. We are faced with a unique organisation that is determined upon killing innocent people in the names of its confusing political demands. Now, I believe that that challenges some of the fundamental principles that I grew up as a lawyer to believe in. And therefore, we have to try and find a way of dealing with that. We can look the other way. We can simply say we are content and comfortable with the kind of society that we have worked hard to establish, that I believe in very strongly. But that society is under real threat. It's under real challenge. It's under challenge on the streets of the United Kingdom from people born and brought up in the United Kingdom. It's the point about preaching jihad. Does any responsible government really allow a preacher to come from the madrasas of Pakistan to preach hate and violence to young people to inculcate in them the possibility that they might become suicide bombers? I have to say, I don't think any responsible government can allow that, because you're allowing the minds of young people to be corrupted by some of the most evil ideas around in the world. Now, I accept these are tough, difficult issues for governments to resolve, but the people that elect governments will not accept the argument that we should look the other way and that we should simply say this is not something for which we have any responsibility. Because we were very fortunate in the United Kingdom. A few weeks after 7/7, another set of suicide bombers tried to detonate another series of bombs in the streets of London. Now, perhaps then the derogation in the European Convention might have been satisfied, because that was beginning to affect the stability and order of our society. Maybe the calmness that London has showed after 7/7 would have been replaced by panic. I know not. What I do know is that we have to take the difficult decisions that are necessary to deal with these threats to our security and our society. And if we fail in that, we will fail our democracy, not only our commitment to civil liberties.
I think even the most ardent civil libertarian would recognize that if someone is charged with a crime, they should be prosecuted. And I think it's important to recognize that simply because there might be criticisms or concerns about military commissions or military justice, that doesn't mean that the traditional civil litigation, criminal litigation system is incapable of effectively prosecuting and punishing perpetrators of international law violations or domestic violations. Last week, David Hicks, Australian who's been at Guantanamo for several years, pled guilty to one count and was punished with 9 months. 5 years ago, in a military commission, 5 years ago, John Walker Lind, the purported American Taliban, pled guilty and was sentenced to 20 years by a federal district court. So it's ironic to see the distinction between the military justice system of last week, 9 months for one count of aiding al-Qaeda, and the federal courts, which imposed a 20-year sentence on an individual for, in essence, the same offense. I think our existing civilian courts are effective, are functioning, and can deal with so many of these purported violations of domestic or international law.
Okay. I find the semantics of the political leaders in both countries to be quite different from the semantics of the both the academics and I guess the let's say outside observers of these questions. The political leaders are always speaking about the severe threats to the fabric to society, if I can paraphrase some of your comments. And I think that in that they're actually probably reflecting, as politicians, as political leaders, the concerns and anxieties of the public. But they are no way, from my point of view, reflecting reality. There are no threats that I've seen, whether it's tall buildings being attacked once every occasionally or underground being attacked, that are actually as potent a threat to the fabric of society as some of these other issues associated with the loss of civil liberties, the mental landscape of a society, the cultural landscape of society, that are actually much more close to the fabric of society. People in this country, I have to admit that people were reacted very badly in ways I didn't fully understand. But they, you know, the sense that they can't go out to dinner with a sense of security is still not the fabric of society. Maybe I define the fabric of society differently. But as anyone I think who's lived in Israel would know, that you know there they tolerate a certain degree of danger. They don't like it and they fight it, but they take somewhat extreme measures. But they still have limits to the measures that they will take. And I guess I'm just saying, every time I hear a political leader say that the fabric of society or the modern society as we know it is threatened by al-Qaeda, I feel a disconnect. I don't see it, and I don't see the benefits, especially when they're actually undermining, some of these measures are actually undermining the real fabric of society from my point of view, and unraveling that.
Okay. Thank you. Well, I don't think Israel's a great example, if you forgive me for saying so. I won't spend a lot of time on that. I visit Israel on a fairly regular basis, and seeing young people afraid to go to bars and cafes and families afraid to go out to restaurants because of the threat of suicide bombing is not something I think is a great illustration of your point. But I accept that there is a judgment, there is a balance, there is a rationale that we have to find for dealing with this threat. What I was really trying to say in my opening remarks was that the law traditionally essentially sees threats from states. International law is largely about the organization of states. The threat that we face today is not about a state actor. It's about an organization that is incredibly sophisticated, that is incredibly dangerous. And in a sense, in response perhaps to the point I didn't deal with earlier, if we don't take action, what is going to happen? Now, you may say that, in your opinion, 3,000 deaths on the streets of New York and toppling towers is the kind of risk that people are prepared to live with.
I just don't think that's true, if you'll forgive me for saying so. I'm being as polite as diplomacy allows. I just do not believe that the people that elect me, the people that elect the government that I serve in, and frankly, the people that elect politicians in this country of either persuasion, I just don't think they will tolerate that level of violence, and I don't think they should. And I think it happened on a regular basis, and that's what these people are after, then there would be a threat to the fabric of our society. And I'm not just using that expression in a semantic sense. I was conscious in London that although people recovered quickly after 7/7, there was a degree of concern that would have been triggered by another series of bombs that were planned for a few weeks later. And we are beginning to see some clear connections between the two groups, that they trained together, and that the fact that they were instigating a series of bombs over a period of time, which is a common pattern that Al-Qaeda have developed over many years, was not entirely coincidental. Now, I can't prove, nor can I prove entirely to the previous gentleman's satisfaction, that the action that we have taken has been effective. All I leave you with is the thought that if we hadn't taken such difficult action, and no one in my position, I assure you, finds it comfortable to take some of these decisions, if we hadn't taken that action, I cannot tell you what kind of problem we would have faced. The security services in the United Kingdom make clear that in the United Kingdom alone, we are following something like 20 different conspiracies today. Now, they are designed to kill people. Now, if any one of those is successful, and we have not taken effective action, I'd like to come and sit out in the audience, because, frankly, they won't be blaming you, they'll be blaming me. And I accept that responsibility, given what I do. So I'd like to think that the reality was the way you describe it. I'm afraid it's not the reality that I see every day.
Well, on that patriotic note, I would like to thank our guest speaker and our panelists for a very stimulating evening, and thank you very much.
You've been listening to a podcast from University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at www.uctv.tv. Thank you for listening.